Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit betterhelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, help.com.
Thanks for downloading this documentary podcast from the BBC World Service. This is a slightly unusual edition of Assignment. There are lots of places and people in it, but it's not about a journey. It's about an idea, about really the nature, the identity of Russia, and how maybe that should change. I wanted to make it because Russia's a country I've studied and loved in many ways for most of my life. And what's puzzled and troubled me in the last 2 years is the way that the reaction among many people, non-Russian and Russian, to the war against Ukraine has been not just to condemn Vladimir Putin and his government, but also to start questioning and even rejecting many other aspects of Russia, Russian music, Russian literature, and so on. What's that all about? My podcast, called Decolonizing Russia, tries to make sense of it.
My name is Sargolana Kondakova. I was born and raised in a small polar village near the Arctic Ocean in the Republic Sakha-Yakutia. It's the largest region of the Russian Federation. My ancestors, they were reindeer herders. I'm not ethnic Russian, but my mother told me that when they were children, they were forbidden to speak their native language, only Russian. It was written in the history books that our lands were opened by the Russian explorers. How can you open the land if there are indigenous peoples living there for thousands of years? But many people still have a colonial mindset. We believe that the Russian big brother is right in everything.
Russian colonialism. Suddenly, since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, it's a phrase you can hear more and more from some inside Russia and from many around its present borders.
My name is Botagoz Kasimbekova. Of course, in Kazakhstan, I grew up with racism. In the Soviet classroom, it was obvious for everyone that Kazakhs were backward, that Russian children were the best. I remember in theater performances, once I actually somehow got a leading role, I was rehearsing for it for several months. And then we had a new student, a Russian student, coming. And that role was immediately given to her. And the explanation of the teacher was that, well, but she's beautiful, she's blonde and blue-eyed, and you're a Kazakh. And that's the colonial history.
Russia had no overseas possessions like Britain or France. But has it remained an empire down to the present day, hiding in plain sight? It's a topic that's got some Western governments talking.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe's congressional briefing on decolonizing Russia, a moral and strategic imperative.
Now, one of the speakers at that briefing was Casey Michel, the American author who kick-started talk of decolonizing Russia.
Russia remains the only European country that hasn't come anywhere close to fully reckoning with its colonial history. That reckoning is coming because after this war that Russia has unleashed, there's no going back to the status quo ante. And that goes for Russia itself.
The argument's simple. It's not just Vladimir Putin's reassertion of Russia's imperial claims that have brought full-scale war back to Europe. It's the whole colonial character of his country. And unless Russia's decolonized or decolonialized, it'll always be a threat to world peace. I'm Tim Hewell, and in this edition of Assignment on the Documentary, here on the BBC World Service, I'm asking whether the term decolonization can really be applied to Russia. And if so, what does it mean in practice? Decolonizing Russian culture? Decolonizing Russian minds? Or maybe even breaking Russia up?
Many people abroad believe that Russia has always existed in the form that it is now, but this is not true.
Sargolana, from the Arctic village in the far northeast of Siberia, is a Yukagir. They're one of the smallest of Russia's more than 160 ethnic minorities.
We lost our war 400 years ago when the so-called Russian explorers arrived in our region. Their goal was so-called soft gold. It was fur, which was very valuable at that time. So there were fierce battles with the local population, the indigenous peoples.
The invasion began in the 16th century. Russia, formerly known as Muscovy, was bursting out of its old bounds in what's now the northwest of the country, east, out of Europe, into Siberia, northern Asia. Its leader, a swashbuckling Cossack adventurer called Yermak, with a beard that hung down to his navel, celebrated in this song by the Russian performer Igor Rastiryaev. Yermak's successors founded Tobolsk, 1,800 kilometres from Moscow in 1587, Krasnoyarsk, 3,300 kilometres in 1628, Yakutsk, 4,900 kilometres in 1632, and Ochotsk on the Pacific, 5,600 kilometres distant in 1647.
Russia expanded and it became the biggest land empire in the world.
Botakoz Kazembekova is now a historian at the University of Basel, Switzerland. She grew up in Kazakhstan, the vast expanse of steppe south of Siberia.
And its methods of colonization did not really differ from other colonial empires. Its guns, divide and rule strategies, sculpting local elites. Basically, it's military takeover of places that were not Russian before and then claiming them to be Russian.
Kazakhstan and other Central Asian territories, today's Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, were conquered by the Tsarist Empire in the 19th century, in the name, of course, of progress.
The barbarism of the Central Asians is so massive, and their economy and society in such decay, that the sooner European civilization penetrates there, from one side or the other, the better.
So wrote the painter Vasily Vereshchagin in 1871. His shimmeringly vivid canvases of the conquest include one of decapitated heads. Russian heads, exhibited on poles after a temporary victory by a Central Asian Khan. And when Vereshchagin talks of civilization coming from one side or the other, he's referring to the British Empire, advancing north into Central Asia from India with its similar civilizing mission. Less than half a century later, the Tsarist Empire collapsed. But its successor, the Soviet Union, retained almost all its territories, including Botakoz Kazembekova's homeland, Kazakhstan.
I remember as a child, my grandmother liked to sit by herself in the room, and she was just staring at one point. And once I somehow went to her and I asked her, "Grandmother, what are you doing?" And she looked at me and she said, "Well, I'm trying to remember the face of my mother."
Botakoz's grandmother grew up in an orphanage because her mother was one of the estimated 1.5 million people, 40% of all Kazakhs, who starved to death in the early 1930s in a famine caused by Stalin's forcible collectivization of agriculture.
Simply because their cattle was taken away for factory workers in Moscow and St. Petersburg.
The details of what happened are harrowing in the extreme.
Little children Many were eaten. So parents actually sold their children.
Eaten?
Yes, they were eaten. So parents sold their children and bought other children not to eat their own children.
They were forced to eat. Sorry, I mean, that's so shocking. I just have to emphasize that. You're saying they were so hungry, people had to eat their own children or other people's children?
Yes, of course.
Of course?
Yes, you need to understand it gets to minus 50 in winter. There is nothing to eat. There are no trees. And people really go mad when they are very, very hungry.
None of that was in Soviet history books. And it was barely known in the outside world either.
Did my Lord deliver Daniel, deliver Daniel?
Bones must still have littered the Kazakh steppe in 1934 when Paul Robeson, the great American singer and anti-colonialist campaigner, made the first of several starry-eyed tours of the Soviet Union. But like others then, he believed communist propaganda and saw the country as a beacon of racial tolerance.
The Soviet Union presented itself as an anti-colonial force. I call it Russian imperial innocence. And it was very successful because people want to have that good story.
Deep in the Cold War, President Ronald Reagan famously called the USSR an evil empire. But even as it was finally falling apart in 1991, his successor, George Bush Sr., told the Ukrainian parliament,
Americans will not support those who seek independence in order to replace a far-off tyranny with a local despotism. They will not aid those who promote a suicidal nationalism based upon ethnic hatred.
Soon afterwards, Ukrainians voted overwhelmingly for their own state. No wonder Bush's intervention has gone down in history as the chicken Kiev speech. But still, until well into this century, many scholars of the post-Soviet space remained stubbornly Russo-centric.
It was always Moscow's or Petersburg's views that were dominant, and this is how we became historians, by reading the stories of growth, of strengthening of Russia.
Until 2 years ago.
Now when we see Ukraine being bombed, it's not only growth of Russia, but it is death of a nation. And I think we start reconsidering the language in which we wrote. Because what Moscow is doing now is something that it did for centuries.
Now, academic and cultural institutions across the world are searching their souls. Have they been too Moscow-orientated? Some writers and artists previously regarded as Russian have been relabeled as Ukrainian or Belarusian or Georgian. Many universities are teaching Ukrainian and other post-Soviet languages and literatures for the first time. Last year, the theme of the world's biggest gathering of scholars of the region was decolonization. But if that rethink has taken so long in the West, how likely is it to happen in Russia itself?
I think the process of reflection about our own imperialism hasn't even started yet.
That's Sasha Manakina, a young Russian who left her country soon after its full-scale attack on Ukraine. She settled in Georgia, also once part of the Soviet Union, and threw herself into voluntary work to help Ukrainians. But she says most Russian exiles, even anti-war activists like her, make little attempt to speak the language of their host country or learn its history.
In general, Russians speak Russian in Georgia. A lot of people hope that they needn't learn Georgian. It's not very sensitive, but it's very strange because people who left Russia, people who against Putin, who against war, also have imperial patterns in themselves. Even intelligent and educated people in Russia, in my age, were using very offensive words about people who are not Russian, or Armenian, Ukrainian, and it was normal. It was like a joke. I don't know why, but in Russia we have a narrative that Russian culture is the greatest culture in the world, and a lot of people didn't understand that the problem, it's not only Putin, it's our minds too, and in our schools, in our textbooks, in our TV shows.
And even, perhaps, in what they're read on their parents' knees.
Царь с царицею простился, путь дорогу снарядился.
This is Oleg Tabakov, who was one of Russia's most celebrated actors, reading a much-loved story, The Tale of the Dead Princess and Seven Knights, by the country's greatest poet, Alexander Pushkin. As in Snow White, there's an evil stepmother, a magic mirror, a cosy cottage, where the princess, still alive at that point, takes refuge. But it belongs not to seven dwarfs, but to seven knights. And whereas the dwarfs, hi-ho, off to work each day at the local diamond mine, Pushkin's seven knights head off for rather more laddish fun, with guns and swords. They shoot ducks, but might also slice the head off a broad-shouldered Tartar, or chase a Circassian out of the forest. Ukrainian filmmaker Irina Tsilik loved the story as a child. Now it feels rather different.
So Alexander Pushkin jokingly writes that these Russian knights, for the sake of morning exercise, go out to shoot representatives of other nations. And it really shocks me. I don't know, it is shocking. These lines were written at the time of the genocide of Circassians by the Russian Empire in the 19th century.
When Russian generals described Circassians as subhuman filth.
But tales by Pushkin are still very popular and unchanged, and they are not discussed properly yet.
Where are the Circassians now? Most survivors of that slaughter, scattered across the Middle East. The remnant in Russia live in several of its national republics. Unlike the 14 non-Russian union republics of the Soviet Union, such as Ukraine, Kazakhstan and Georgia, the autonomous republics within Russia, for originally conquered peoples such as the Yakuts, the Tatars, the Buryats, as well as the Circassians, didn't break free in 1991. But now, in some of them, discontent is stirring.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's all online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's betterhelp.com.
Hundreds of demonstrators in Bashkortostan, central Russia, clashed with police as they demanded the release of a jailed activist. He'd campaigned to preserve the indigenous language Bashkir and opposed environmentally harmful mining operations. It was one of the largest protests anywhere in Russia in the last 2 years, but not the first in a minority ethnic region. In Yakutia, in the far northeast, homeland of Sargolana, the descendant of reindeer herders, more than 500 women danced hand in hand in a huge circle in the capital, Yakutsk. They were protesting against the mobilisation of Yakut men for the war. Non-ethnic Russian regions have been forced to provide a disproportionately high number of soldiers to fight and die in Ukraine. Sargolana wasn't there. She left Russia when it first attacked Ukraine in 2014 and now lives 11,000 kilometres away.
Outside, yeah, I can see the eucalyptus trees. Beautiful sunset.
I live in Melbourne.
I miss my land. I want to go back someday, but I love Australia.
From there, she helps run an organisation, Free Yakutia, which organised the protests on social media. It's part of a wider movement of activists, many now exiled from national republics. They want decolonisation. What does decolonisation mean in practice?
Decolonisation is not the collapse of the country for us. The peoples themselves, they must decide if they want to stay within Russian Federation, which is not real one, or they want to be an independent state. That's all about self-determination.
And not just to preserve their culture. Yakutia, for example, is also rich in oil, gas and diamonds.
Billions go to Moscow and in return we get very little money. There is a lot of corruption, not enough schools, not enough hospitals, not enough comfortable housing, no railway.
This is never going to happen in practice, is it? I mean, the forces against it are so strong, you know, not only Putin himself, but maybe even most Russian people.
It is a very slow process. We tell them the truth about their history, about social, political, economical inequality. So they should wake up. They can open their eyes to what is happening in the country. That's why the Kremlin is scared of us a lot.
What the Kremlin claims to be scared of is something different. Not of its own people, but of Western or Ukrainian plots to dismember Russia. And Ukraine's security chief, Kirill Budanov, certainly had a map of Russia split into separate states. But many in the West would be horrified at the possibility of Russia breaking up.
Russia is a nation state. 80% of its population is ethnic Russian.
Kavor Kaskanyan, political scientist at Exeter University.
In most of the subdivisions of that federation, even those subdivisions that are named after other ethnicities, the Russians are actually the majority.
Because those conquerors of once non-Russian land brought settlers in their wake.
And that brings us to the difference between decolonizing Russia and decolonizing the Western empires. In the Western empires, decolonizing basically meant withdrawing administrators, some military station there, and handing it over. This is much more reminiscent to what you had in the former Yugoslavia, intermingled ethnic groups. If it happens, it will probably be an extremely violent affair. But wishing for it, as some do, I think is really playing with fire.
Particularly, Dr. Oskanian thinks, if those talking of decolonizing Russia are just jumping on the bandwagon of an intellectually fashionable theory.
The problem with decolonization when it's applied to Russia is where it's really about scoring geopolitical points by using decolonization as a tool to weaken Russia, to foment separatism within Russia. So when you see, for instance, think tanks that have a very strong neoconservative slant, that have absolutely no problem in using colonial discourses towards the Middle East or towards sub-Saharan Africa, suddenly come out with conferences on decolonizing Russia, you give the West a free pass by being selective. If you do that in scholarship, you risk basically replacing Russian hegemony with Western hegemony.
Hypocrisy, he's alleging. And in countries that struggled against Western colonialism, that were supported in that struggle by the Soviet Union, many would agree.
So what is this decolonization we speak about? This is a geopolitical circus. And why should we even seriously discuss it? Because it is a theater of the absurd.
M.K. Bhadrakumar, former Indian diplomat, now a prolific foreign affairs blogger.
We could have spoken of decolonization in Canada. We could have certainly spoken of the decolonization of Australia. But then they were all, you know, buried in history. And therefore, nobody speaks about it. Nothing of the sort happened in Tsarist Russia. They didn't have this kind of ethnic cleansing which the Anglo-Saxon people practiced in North America.
Mr. Bhadrakumar knows Russia well and Central Asia. He was ambassador to Uzbekistan. What then of the famine in neighbouring Kazakhstan? I talked to a Kazakh historian. She described, you know, how every single person in her grandmother's family died in the famine.
What has it got to do with colonialism, my friend? Horrific things took place. Famine was not a phenomenon in Kazakhstan alone. And it has nothing to do with race. But if you really want to look at it, that kind of a famine and attach it to colonialism, come to India. That is the Bengal famine. And the British saw it in front of their eyes and they didn't even move their little finger.
Is the Bengal famine of 1943 more or less a result of colonialism than the Kazakh famine? The answer depends, at least partly, on your political standpoint.
The problem is that when you decolonize and you want to create a national identity, you emphasize certain parts of history and de-emphasize others.
Political scientist Kevork Askanian again.
For instance, in Ukraine, you might end up rehabilitating figures who are not up for rehabilitation simply because they fit into the narrative about pushing back against Russian colonialism. Figures like Stepan Bandera.
Bandera led a fight for Ukrainian independence in World War II. He's demonized by the Kremlin as a Nazi collaborator. But today there are many streets named after him in Ukraine, though followers of his have been blamed for the massacre of tens of thousands of Poles and Jews.
Extreme right-wing individuals suddenly become heroes in spite of having engaged in all kinds of atrocities. And the great risk is that, you know, because we are living through this great confrontation, that is then projected backwards. History is then simplified into this narrative of Russia versus everyone else, when actually there's a much more complicated story there.
So, should we be talking about decolonization at all? Have we pushed a parallel too far? Yaroslav Hrtsak is the author of a new history of his country, Ukraine, The Forging of a Nation. He's part of an international research project that aims to retell Ukrainian history outside a Russian context. But he sees arguments ahead.
Ukrainian history is very much tricky stuff. When Russia was building the empire, Ukrainians played the role as the Scots in the British Empire. Scots was very much keen to make a career in the centre of the British Empire.
So to spell out then, there were very many Scottish civil servants, Scottish imperial officers all around the empire. They became, even though they were a different nation from the English, they became agents and indeed eager, keen agents of empire themselves.
Without a doubt. And in the Ukrainian case, by some estimations, the half of the Russian imperial elites in the 18th century were Ukrainians.
Wow.
And you have more or less the same situation the final years of the Soviet Union. So you could hardly call this a colony.
Not a colony after all, then. But hang on. The Ukrainians started as Scots, but finished, Professor Hrtsak believes, as Irish, a genuinely colonised nation that fought for its freedom, as Ukraine is now fighting. And he hopes an eventual Ukrainian victory will be a wake-up call to decolonise Russia too.
War is a tragedy, but also I would say war had created a kind of opportunity. The best thing that could happen to Russia nowadays is that Russia would lose the war and start to change its political regime. This is the long process, but war makes things that was considered impossible possible.
Military defeat triggered the fall of other land empires, the Austro-Hungarian, the Ottoman. But Russia's far from defeated. Recently, it's gained ground in Ukraine, and Western sanctions have had less effect than expected. Sasha, the Russian exile in Georgia, thinks it'll be a long time before she goes home.
No. I'm absolutely lose any optimistic thoughts. I think that this big country didn't should exist in this form. But I don't believe that there is something good with Russia in nearest decades. Even Putin will die if he die. A lot of people have this mindset too. We're going to hell. I'm sorry.
But Sargolana in Melbourne dreams on. Decolonization, she thinks, must start in people's minds.
If the people stay with the same slave-like mindset, nothing will change.
But slow at first, as the steps in a Yakut dance, and then maybe gathering pace, she believes change will come to her icy homeland.
We understand that this dictatorship can't last forever, and history shows that everything can happen any day, very quickly. Yes.
Thanks for listening. That podcast was produced and presented by me, Tim Hewell, with sound mixing by Hal Haynes. The production coordinators were Maria Ogundele, Sabine Sherek and Gemma Ashman, and the editor, Richard Fenton-Smith.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.